Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
All right, and welcome back. We appreciate everybody for coming and tuning in. Double appreciate everybody who came back here to chat D3 Lax, and specifically to talk national championship preview. With me, as always, is my buddy, my big dog, Caleb Abney. How we doing, bud?
Dan, loving life. Swarm season has ended. We're going into summer ball, so looking forward to some championship action, and then, you know, get into some summer ball. It's going to be fun.
And D3 May Madness has been elite. I hope everybody has been able to catch all of this action and kind of see things live and playing out, because the games have been incredible. But for those who haven't, we'll talk a little bit about it. Before we do that, though, we have a very, very special segment, and it's our national championship preview. We get one of these a year, and I'm thrilled to dive in and talk a little bit about the nitty-gritty of this matchup and these two teams. And so to go ahead and do so, we'll have Big Dog take over the host role, and I'll jump in to the analysis role and be ready to kind of provide some insight here.
Yeah, let's get into it here. And just so everybody knows, very exciting stuff, but Dan's going to be on the color commentator for the game. Going to be pretty sweet. I'm looking forward to listening to it there. I was telling Dan, I think this is the first one I've actually listened to in the past like 4 or 5 years, just because we've been there at this point, and you know, we've been a part of it on game day. So that's
Did you go with me to RIT Union?
No, I didn't go to. That was the last one that I missed. So
got
this,
it.
Yeah, so you'll be making the trip up to Boston, and I'll be holding down the fort back in Maryland down here. But
as much as I will definitely miss you, I'll FaceTime you a few times along the way.
I want to see Gillette. I want to see the inside, yeah. All the cool stuff back there.
I have a pretty good crew. I'm excited for it. So my nephew is interning for Inside Lacrosse this summer, so he's along for the ride. And then his buddy, kid that he's been friends with for a long time, is also interning for Inside Lacrosse. So between the two of them, like being best friends and interning for us this summer, I'm excited for that. So they'll pick me up real early on Sunday morning, and we're going to drive up. It'll be a one-day trip, but because I have a couple of drivers, so to speak, I'll be able to make sure I'm nice and rested and prepped and all that type of stuff. So yeah. I'm excited, and I'll say just quickly, like, I, you know, obviously we're here to talk about the two teams, we're here to talk about the game, and I'm certainly not a huge piece of either one of those things, but I am definitely excited.
Well deserved. It's going to be awesome. I bring that all up though to say that you cannot in good conscience pick out a winner for this game. Like, you can't side one way or another. The broadcast has to be a true black and white, true 50-50. So
no doubt. Michael,
a couple extra big dogs, big takes for the championship game, just to get in there where Dan can't really do it. So looking forward to giving the people some good stuff here. Cool. All right, well, let's get into the game here. I think this is an awesome matchup. You got the Cinderella story versus the cool kids on the block that have been there year after year. So it's such a great matchup, such a great storyline on either side. There's so many things that you can dive into here. So let's get into the first one that I think is going to be a really big point, and that's going to be the faceoff X. Ben Trusick has been dominating through this playoff stretch. He's been a big part of why they've been in it. But Salido and Parker Merrill, both for Tufts, have been excellent this year. So this is really going to be a battle of the Titans at the faceoff X. And we talk about how important it is. Tufts goes on these two, three, four goal runs that just really drown teams out. So if you can win the faceoff X and be competitive there, that really takes away more possessions and gives them a little bit less of an advantage that they would normally have.
Yeah, really well said. And I'll expand on that a little bit. And I'll just add, like, when it comes to reverse engineering a victory in this game for either team, it starts here. And so I think that this is kind of the hinge point, right? If you were to look at matchups and kind of a head-to-head basis for a lot of, you know, the defender versus attackman is the typical where you kind of lean towards, or shooters versus goalies, or, you know, midfielder one versus LSM one, right? Like, those are kind of your typical matchups that you look to in like a head-to-head capacity. This one, I think, is just the most important for a variety of reasons, right? And we're going to get into some of the actual keys to the game for each team, but among those, the most important ones will be like instilling their pace. This is a team of two very clashing styles, and the way that you're going to most be able to kind of instill your will there or have some sort of say over, you know, that pace is at the faceoff X. And I think that that's obviously kind of where that, like I said, this game kind of hinges in that point. And if it comes to reverse engineering it, and you can tell Tufts right now that they're going to go 75-80%, they're going to be, you know, really, really happy with that result and think, okay, that's going to equal a W. And for Dickinson, while I don't think that it's going to be so much of a 1+1 situation where, like, if that happens, then very clearly they would be winning, right? I think there's still a lot of other things that have to go right for them. But the very first one starts with, you know, competing at that faceoff X and winning possession there so that you can kind of control more of that pace and tempo.
Yep, I think that's well said, and it really leads into the keys of the game. So let's get into that for Dickinson. First thing I think that's really important for them, they've been doing it throughout this entire run that they've had in the tournament so far, and that's slowing down the pace and keeping composure and really maintaining those possessions. You know, they have to get deep into those shot clocks, but they have to be aggressive at the same time. You know, if there's an 8-yard shot that someone's got their hands free, they have to take that. You know, you got to bury it, but you have to take that. You can't be scared. But at the end of the day, you really have to work deep into these possessions, slow the game down a little bit, and that's going to lead to Tufts maybe pressuring a bit more, getting them off their normal game. So I think that's a really, really key component for Dickinson to have.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You know, and one thing that I'll add is, I think early in the year, this was a Dickinson team that maybe didn't know that this was going to be the identity that they needed to go to be successful, right? Like, I think in mainstream lacrosse, you had a lot of talk about Virginia this season, and Virginia, you know, didn't have the greatest season ever. And a lot of the issues that people were pointing to were stemming from, like, the pace that they want to play. And they are so used to this, like, run and gun style and this, that, and the other that allows them to push and constantly, you know, play at that high speed. And it didn't fit their personnel. And I think a little bit of that same narrative applies to Dickinson, but less on the, like, you know, Dickinson isn't exactly who you think of when you think of that same, like, UVA run and gun style. The next team that you think of isn't necessarily Dickinson. But I think that the concept and, you know, the idea of, like, okay, we were a team that maybe wasn't 100% convinced or 100% committed to slowing the pace, saw early in the season the woes that, you know, they had when they didn't do that, and then later in the season started to see some of the success that comes with slowing that pace. And then, you know, that is kind of what goes hand in hand with, like, you know, that along with getting healthy and getting some better goalie play. But, like, just as important as those two latter points was the decision consciously to kind of, you know, start to slow the pace, get deep into shot clocks, and start trying to be the most efficient team possible and not trying to, you know, really ramp up possession or pace numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said there. And then outside of that, we talked about it quite a bit, but they have to have a complete game at the faceoff X. They have to be out there competing at it, making it a battle. And then they have to be able to have urgency to defend off of that faceoff, you know, because they're not going to win every single one of them. And we know Tufts likes to get downhill right away off that. So they got to have urgency, ready to go there, pick up any sort of fast breaks that go on, make Tufts settle it down and play true 6-on-6 offense.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think, you know, if we were to point to three points and just kind of in a summary aspect, it's like compete at the X, have great urgency after it, right? If you don't win the faceoff, you're going to have great urgency after it to defend. And if you do win it, you also need to be really urgent to turn that win into an actual possession, right? You're going to have jump doubles. You're going to see if, say, faceoff guy for Dickinson wins it, throws it to the wing and starts to sub, right? Like, whoever he just threw the ball to on the wing is now in this position where they're getting doubled. Like, you have to be poised, and you have to be able to manage those situations, and you have to understand with urgency every single step of what's next, right? I think anticipating that next step, anticipating what's going to be asked of you in that moment is really important. And so I think regardless of the result of the face-off, it's the urgency that follows it afterwards that is equally important.
Yep. Yep. Well said. I think those two things there that we talked about at the end too are really going to limit how much Tufts is able to go on those runs that they inevitably Bingo. Always go on. So
you nailed it.
Thank you. Thank you. So I think big stuff there needed from Dickinson, but very, very attainable for him. You know, they've been doing it against really great teams. We'll get into it later, but they've done it time after time again against some awesome teams in this tournament. So I definitely think it's within their wheelhouse to manage all those keys there. But we'll move on to the keys of the game for Tufts.
Before we do, I'll just quickly add, like, if I was to give you a fourth, like, those are all very scheme, X's and O-y, like, you know, kind of pinpoint. You can look at those and define those. At the end of the game, you're going to be able to look back and say, like, did we do these things to accomplish these goals? And undefinable is, like, managing the moment, right? Like, I mean, almost none of what I just said matters at all if they get to championship weekend and spend the whole time looking around and are just like overwhelmed by the moment, right? Like, and frankly, it's possible. Like, I don't know that if I was in their shoes, I wouldn't be doing the same, right? It's got to be an incredible experience. It's going to be the largest crowd that they've ever played in front of. You know, Tufts has their own draw, but they're also in Massachusetts, right? They're right around the corner. So you have this, like, ultimate just, like, Boston lax fest that Dickinson is going into to try and crash as also the underdog. So, like, they have this, like, mounting task in front of them that for us to kind of not even mention just, like, the emotions of it or the fact that Tufts is undefeated and, like, all of those types of things that are just, like, stacking against them to make this that proverbial David versus Goliath, like, that all matters as well. And there's a degree that, like, everything we just said scheme wise and those points just, like, you know, they may not matter, but if they are able to manage the moment and sink into the game and, like, it comes down to executing, like, those are the points that, you know, they're going to be most hopeful or kind of leaning their way after 60 minutes.
We'll shift to the Tufts keys of the game, which I think first one for me, and you just alluded to it with Dickinson, but it's managing the moment for them at the same time. You know, might be a little bit of a different management because they've been there multiple times at this point. I mean, Garzone, this is his fourth year. I think this is the third national championship he's been to. So I don't think the moment's going to be too big for them per se. And it's going to feel almost like a super home game with what you just said being Boston Lax Fest there that day. So there is a lot riding on it, though. So there's going to be a lot of pressure, a lot of fans there. It's the biggest stage possible to play on in D3 lacrosse. So how are you going to manage that moment? How are you going to manage your emotions to make sure the game flows in your direction?
And the biggest difference between this team, right, and last year was three losses. Last year's team had three setbacks along the way to kind of either, you know, whatever you think the benefit of it is, whether it's just like a mental reshift or like you take the film more seriously when you feel the weight of a loss or whatever it is, right? Like, but in 2023, when they saw Salisbury, they were undefeated at that point as well. And so there's a little bit of the, like, you know, that lingering in the back of your head of, like, you know, undefeated national champion is a little bit different than national champion. And I'm sure, like, it's easy for us to say here sitting on a podcast that that's a little bit different. I bring that up partially because you'll hear it in the interview coming up, but Coach Dolphins literally says, like, we had this conversation with our guys where we were like, okay, at the beginning of the season, like, who put on their goals to go undefeated? Nobody raises their hand. Okay. Who put on their goals to go, win a national championship? Everybody raises their hand. So, like, you know, for them, it's a little bit, like, out of sight, out of mind, doesn't really matter. But, like, to me, talking to you on a podcast, I think they know at the end of it, like, in the back of their head, that there's a little bit of that sentiment and that the last time that they were in that situation, it just, you know, didn't fall in their favor.
Yep, definitely. I think it's going to be a big feat if they can pull it off. Another thing that they're going to need to do to pull it off, though, is instill their identity. We just talked about how Dickinson is going to need to slow it down if they're going to have a chance in this game. Tufts, they need to play their game. They need to dictate the tempo, speed them up, get the shots that they need, get the all the possessions that they normally get in order to get all those shots. So it's going to be really important for them to instill their identity in this one.
Yep, no doubt. Yep.
Love that. And last one I think I got here is great short stick midi play. You know, I think they have really tough pulls that are great on ground balls. They're great on coverage one-on-one. They can take it away from you at any point in time. So I think the difference makers here are going to be the short stick D middies. You know, how are they doing on their one-on-one matchups? Can they hold them to tight shots and then get up and out at the end of the day too?
Yeah, I think two things to add to that. I think part of the reason that has to be a key is just because of how Dickinson's offense is very predicated on hunting those short stick matchups. Like every once in a while, they'll attack a pull, but to get things starting, they're very much so going to hunt those short sticks and kind of use that. And I feel like in general, within Division III lacrosse, you kind of have two schools of thought. It's like, okay, maybe three schools of thought, maybe, but few fall into the first category that I'll give, which is like an elite playmaker that can create off of his own, off the dribble, by himself against a pole, right? Like only a handful of teams have that. The second bucket is like you have somebody who can create, they can go at a pole, but they need a pick. So you two-man a lot, you send him a pick, or you live with what happens after that. And then the third is like, we don't really dodge poles. We hunt short sticks. And we'll attack poles off approaches, or we'll attack poles off, off the end line, or we'll attack poles in our, like, comfort spots. But in general, like, as a philosophy to kind of get things started, we're going to really, find those short stick matchups and hope that our fourth best dodger is better than whatever short stick you have on the field, and then try and take advantage of that matchup in a spot that really, makes defenses susceptible and vulnerable. And one of those, I think, is just the single invert, right? And so short stick D mids are going to have to be awesome on ball for Tufts because of, like I said, Dickinson's going to hunt them. But also, I think Dickinson has been at their best in those instances, and sometimes it involves an invert, and that could potentially put some of those short stick D mids in spots where they're uncomfortable. And so I think that overall, like, you're absolutely right. Like the just instilling your will, speeding them up has to be one of the points of emphasis, and then those short stick D mids being great on ball. And you mentioned like slide tempo and breakout tempo, both of those things are really important and two things that they do really well. And, you know, those guys anticipate the breakout better than anybody. They anticipate that their adjacent defender, their adjacent teammate is going to pick up a ground ball, and therefore they don't even need to think about going. They can just be breaking up field better than anybody. And I think that, you know, that's all stuff that we know that they do well. And to kind of elevate their game and elevate their play and elevate their team in the national championship game, being awesome on ball is going to be just as important as those things.
Yeah, very well said. Anything you want to add to the Tufts keys of the game before I can get into a little prediction personally?
No. Give us your predictions. I think in general for keys of the game, like we said, like it's going to be so much of like, you know, manage the moment so that you can execute in it. And you're going to hope that at the end of the day, you make enough plays within those things that you don't sit here saying like, man, we had them right there. We just couldn't execute on the things that we wanted to control. And if you end up on the wrong side of the scoreboard as a result of things that fall outside of those things, perhaps you can live with it.
Yep. There we go. So I'm going to give my personal prediction, and then I'm going to pretend to be you for a second and give the prediction that I think you would give, even though okay, you can't give one. So first one, my personal prediction. I'm not shy about saying that I've been hot on Dickinson since the start of the year. I never wavered. Picked them to be a Final Four team on the first pod. You can go back to my Twitter and check it out. And I'm not going to waver. I think this Cinderella run is incredible. It's such a great story, and I think the way that they've changed their identity from the first part of the season to now has been super impressive. Like, you got to give a ton of credit to Coach Webby, like just the phenomenal job that he's done on in-season turning this whole thing around. So I'm going to ride the Dickinson wave, the Red Devil wave. I'm going to ride it in, give a 13-12 final. Dickinson goes off to win it on top.
You get to cheat. You get to take the cooler narrative and then just yes, throw out whatever. Okay. So that's one potential path. That's one potential path.
One way. Now I get
to be out of fork in the road. Some people are veering left. Some people are veering right.
Yeah. So now I get to be Dan Kaplan and put a little bit more of an X's no brain on and say that, you know, this Dickinson run's been a lot of fun. They've had a you know, great, still everything I said about Coach Webby still applies here. But at the end of the day, I think Tufts tempo is going to be a little bit too much, and that might hop on the Red Devils early and crush them there. So if I'm Dan Kaplan, I'm given a 14-10 prediction of a Tufts win there.
All right. No comments. Like I said, yeah. I get to be in the booth for this one, so I won't go jeopardizing that by offering commentary that is unnecessary, because you did such a good job.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. I might have to be your double. If you ever get sick or something, I can hop in and fill in for you. Yeah.
Yeah, the understudy. That's a great plan.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Let's take a break for a second, and then we'll come on back and talk a little bit about some of the semifinal and Elite Eight action. All right.
Perfect.
Okay. Keeping this thing chugging along here. I feel like even, and this is for years to come, when it comes to the 2025 weekend that was the Elite Eight and semifinals, there's one matchup that we're all going to look at, one matchup that we'll all remember, and therefore there's one spot that we as a podcast have to start with, and that's Dickinson 12, RIT 10. What were your initial reactions?
Dan, this was insane, dude. I mean, a generational run from the Red Devils. You got Dennison in overtime, Salisbury in overtime, RPI, they've been a top 10 team all year. Now RIT, like, this is ridiculous, dude. Like, absolutely ridiculous, an unheard of run. Never, except for I did predict it a little bit in the beginning of the year, but never would I ever see this coming from the Red Devils here. So just generational run is, I would say, the two words to sum it all up.
I think it's awesome, right? I think it's really cool from a bunch of different perspectives. It's really cool for Dickinson. It's really cool for Coach Webster, who is one of D3's, you know, very just like well-liked and respected coaches. And there's a ton of them. So for him to be, you know, among the top of that group, I think, you know, speaks wonders. So from that perspective, he's an alum of Dickinson. He's been there at the helm for 24 years. So like from all of those types of things, I think that, you know, it's really interesting. But then if you also just consider like the build and like the makeup of most Division III institutions and most Division III teams, they fit a little bit more and align a little bit more with Dickinson, than Tufts. Right. And so for Dickinson to be kind of, you know, pushing the boundary and in the national championship right now and you know, reaching points that they hadn't previously reached, it is inspiring to the rest of Division III, right? Like there's 10, 15, 20 other teams that weren't that much worse, right? Or weren't that much different, or, you know, their structure, their, like, what their university offers isn't that much different. And so now, like, at any given point during the next few seasons, you're going to very easily be able to say, like, why not us? And then look to this Dickinson team as like a very clear example, you know, and they're a team that they had guys injured early. They were 3-4 at one point in the season. And now they're sitting here headed into the national championship. And it's just like an unbelievable turnaround that, quite frankly, is inspiring for the entirety of Division III.
Yeah, the people's champ is what we can call them.
No doubt. They're the people's champ. Yeah. No doubt. Now, they also, like, I mean, this is an interesting aspect of the game, right? Like, Tufts is kind of has this, like, evil empire vibe to them, right? Like, they have plenty of enemies within the Division III, like, athletics world, right? Like, everybody loves to hate on winners, right? The Chiefs, tons of haters. The Patriots, tons of haters, right? Like, if you think about any dynasty in any sport at any time, like, you win enough, you become the heel. And I think that that's kind of where Tufts is at. And now you have this, like, knight in shining armor that is Webby's army in the Dickinson Red Devils that, like, you know, align a lot more with, you know, kind of the rest of Division III in a way that, like, I think is, you know, just like I said, really inspiring and has a lot of lore to the game.
Yeah, definitely agree. So this RIT Dickinson game, what was your thoughts and feelings rolling through it here? Like, did you see this coming watching the game? Were you expecting an RIT push late? What did you see here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm like programmed to think that RIT is just always going to RIT the same way that you're programmed to think that Salisbury is going to Salisbury, right? And so, like, for me, I just kept waiting for this, like, this punch and, like, the way that RIT runs and, like, and they're able to score, like, in rapid succession and they're able to, just over time, right? Like, we've said this on the last couple of podcasts, like, RIT does what RIT does better than any other team does what they do, except in this game, right? Like, and it's just such a weird instance of like there were a lot of really uncharacteristic mistakes from RIT. Like, I don't want to take anything away from Dickinson, who showed up there, punched him in the face, went up 5-1, and walked away with a W. But like, that was the worst RIT product that I can recall ever watching or evaluating, at least within the last few years. And it was very uncharacteristic in a lot of different ways. I think one example that I'll give you is at the end of the first quarter, RIT is always so efficient with their offense. And even if they're not, even if the ball in this instance doesn't end up in the back of the net, it never ends up in the back of their own net. Except in this situation here against Dickinson. And again, it's an RIT ball with like 15 seconds on the clock heading towards the end of the first quarter. And they go to initiate, and the ball carrier gets stripped, loses it at the top of the box. Dickinson has numbers going the other way, and they score really late in the first quarter. And like, it's just a huge momentum shifting play. And it's like, that was that sequence. Like, RIT doesn't do that. RIT doesn't do that. And in that moment, they did, right? And I think, like, from RIT fans' perspective, it's like, what are we doing type things. And you say that over and over and over again, waiting until you do what you typically do, and then the typical never came.
Yep, agreed. It was quite the sight to see, and I think it's a harsh reality, but at the end of the day, I think you're right. This is one of the not as great RIT products that we saw throughout the past this year at least, but past few years. So definitely shocking to see, but end of the day, I think Dickinson deserved it more. They wanted it more. They came out ready to fight, and they took what they needed there.
And I'll define they wanted it more a little bit. They outground balled RIT like in a dominant way in the second half.
Which
And
you don't see that. You don't see
no.
that very often.
And I thought that, like, again, we keep talking about it as it relates to Tufts, like that's going to be one of the most important things, right? Like ground ball play, limiting possessions, even if it's just like in your own end, right? And now you get another shot at like, a 60-second shot clock because you scrapped back a rebound. That's really important relative to you take a shot and the rebound ends up in a Tufts defender stick, and there's a Tufts short stick D-mid that's already broken out and kind of hanging out at midfield, and now they're pushing a 6v5 break and you're in trouble, right? And so like those aspects of things are going to be really important. And against RIT, what it was also really important, they won that battle. Do you have just got to throw it out, right? Like the other aspects of characteristic things, right? Like I got to define my work. I got to define my words a little bit and show my work a little bit because I said that it was such a bad product from the Tigers. And frankly, we've praised them a lot over the years, so I don't feel too bad. And I don't know that their coaches would disagree that it was a bad product compared to what they typically put out on the field. But six penalties, right? I think that they're usually one of the most disciplined teams in the country. And if they're taking chances or if they are fouling, it's because of like an aggressive play in the middle of the field or whatever it was. And I thought that there were just some uncharacteristic penalties, not like, chippiness or chirping or anything, but like just penalties that didn't need to happen. And then next thing you know, like even if it didn't end up in the back of their net as a result of it, like it certainly disrupted an offensive flow that, was evident, right? And I think that over the course of time, it was like not only did they have to deal with a Dickinson defense that was, really detail oriented, but they also had to deal with like their own flow issues. And part of those own flow issues that they were experiencing was a result of having fouled.
Yep, Yeah, well said. I think one other point we missed in this too is Dickinson's resiliency. If they played RIT in the Mustang Classic and lost 24-7. Like, that is a monster whopping at that point. So to come back on RIT's home field and do this to them in the NCAA playoffs is just another like a cherry on top to this whole run of why this is such a generational run.
It just makes it even more, just unbelievable. And that game, like, if you look at the first half box score of that game, it is abysmal for Dickinson, right?
We were
Like,
there, yeah.
we
We
were.
watched it.
They did an attempt to clear in the first quarter. So what that equates to is they didn't make a stop, right? So they didn't have a single save, and they didn't make a single defensive stop. They were down 8-0 at that point. 8-0 at the end of the first. It was 15-2 at halftime. At this game, in this moment, going into the fourth quarter in May, in the NCAA semifinals, going into the fourth quarter, it's 11-8. At the Mustang Classic, going into the fourth quarter at that same point, same two teams, it was 20-4, right? Like, it's just the most outrageous turnaround that you could possibly even think of, right? And it's just. It's such a testament to Coach Webby and, the work that those guys have put in. And he gives a lot of credit to their senior leadership as well. And, really, it's like, if they're to pull this thing off, it's like write a book. He's got to write a book.
Love that. I'd be the first in line
Two-part
on it.
podcast.
Love that. Good. All right. So I think we hit the Dickinson run pretty good there. Let's talk about the Tufts run a little bit and how they got here real quick. It started on Saturday with the game against Gettysburg. Dan, talk about this one a little bit and what you saw here.
Yeah, so I think again, it's actually this is a really good. I'm glad you brought this up. I think that we can pretty quickly hit most of these games, these Elite Eight games, and we'll do a really good job of kind of recapping everything at the end of the season after the national championship. We'll do like an awards show, and we'll talk about some of these teams who did have some really strong runs. And maybe aren't getting the shine that they deserve right now in the moment while the national championship is getting that shine. And that's how it should be, in my opinion. But what I'll say is, as it relates to this game, Gettysburg gives Dickinson the blueprint in the first quarter of exactly how important defending off the faceoff is. And so in that game, it gets the quarter ends 7-2, and Gettysburg scores to make it 3-2. And then off of the next face-off, Tufts scores, so now we're 4-2. And then off of the very next face-off after that goal, Tufts scores again. And so, like, I don't have the times in front of me. I would bet you it's within, I bet you all three goals, Gettysburg goal to the second Tufts goal, is all within like a 15-second span. And so just as quickly as you were able to stack a little bit of momentum and have a little bit of energy within your sideline, you give up two the other way. And it's all gone. Those runs are fueled by great offense, efficient goal, whatever it is, a transition goal, something happens on the defensive end, a save, a clean outlet, some sort of sick, rusty gate check. And now the ball's on the ground, it's a goal in transition. Next phase, goal off of the face-off. Next phase, they win that face-off, score 6-on-6 again. And next thing you know, you got scored on in three different ways in less than 3 minutes. And it's like, your head starts to spin. You don't know what you actually need to address. You don't know what you actually need to, fix defensively, what the biggest issues are. And, it just kind of spirals from there. And again, it can all hinge on at the face-off there. If you're able to stop the bleeding every once in a while by just winning a face-off, securing the possession and getting to less than, we'll say, 15 seconds in the shot clock and getting a quality opportunity in the path.
Yeah, and I think that's a good segue into the Tufts Bowdoin game that happened on Sunday as well, which we saw Tufts just blow the doors off of Bowdoin, which was pretty surprising. They met in the regular season. This was a really tight game that came down to the wire, but Tufts turns it around and just continues on this war path that they're on, winning by 15 goals here. So, Dan, what'd you see from this one?
Yeah, I think I don't have a ton of like specific in-game details on this one, but the two points I'll make about this, early season games against Wesleyan and Bowdoin, both really tight games, right? Like, you think back to the Wesleyan game, that's the game that we had, like, the goal controversy, right? Was it a goal? Was it not a goal? Twice, right? The one where there was the tight on the crease, so, like, really controversial, could have gone either way, you know, right there. Then a similar play, also involving a crease dive at the end of the Bowden game. Bowden ends up on the wrong side of that call. Tufts ends up on the right side of that call. They end up with a W in the books there as well. Now, fast forward, you turn into May, and you've had Tufts play both of those teams again, and the combined outcome of those is a 27-goal win against those two teams, right? Like, a 12-goal win against one and a 15-goal against the other. And so what that leads me to do is, like, and I asked Coach this in the NCAA conference call media availability earlier this week, just laid that out, and, like, do you think that Tufts is peaking as a result of, like, those, you know, outcomes? And to me, I think, like, you know, yes. But for him, he was like, you know, that's the hope, right? We hope that we're at that point this season. And, you know, the other thing that's interesting about it is, like, so many coaches, and I fall into this, I fall victim of this myself, is, like, you play a game, it's tight, but you end up pulling it out. You don't hit the film the same way. You just don't. You know, when you feel the weight of the loss, and he credits them to have, like, taking it that way, right? Like, really feeling the weight of it, not having rested on the fact that they ended up in the W side of it, but really going back, addressing the film, and then coming back and, you know, gave a ton of credit to the rest of the coaches and his staff as well for them to be able to identify a few things and come back and address them. And so, you know, I just think that that whole aspect of things is interesting. And to me, I think it leads me to believe, like, you know, this is a team that feels like they're peaking when it's, you know, in a moment that makes it scary.
I think that's a good segue into our or to your interview with Coach D'Onofrio there.
And I apologize that you were unable to join us, but you got to make that money, honey. So we forgive you. We forgive you. And yeah, I was really thrilled to be able to connect with him. I know that, you know, these weeks are crazy for coaches. They have an increase in the media availability. They have the most important game that they are involved in potentially of their lives coming up. So they have all the scout and everything that needs to go into that. Ton of travel prep, which is a little bit lighter for Coach D'Onofrio at Tufts than for Coach Webby at Dickinson. But either way, you still have a lot of those types of things. Just so many different moving pieces. So we really appreciate him for taking a few minutes to connect. And yeah, like I said, really appreciate that time. And I think we had a good conversation talking all things considering, you know, scout and what this Dickinson team is doing to take down all these head honchos. And what, you know, Tufts is going to hope to be able to do and, you know, what fans should be able to expect if maybe they aren't so familiar with this Tufts team. So a really good interview, and we really appreciate Coach D'Onofrio for taking the time for us.
Yep, love that. And if you think we're just getting Tufts, don't worry. We interviewed Coach Webby last week. Feel free to go back, watch that video last week. We talk in depth with Coach Webby. So we got both the coaches on here. Lovely stuff.
Yeah, that's a good shout. And at this point, like, the game action that we talk about with him is probably a little out of date because that was after the round of 32 and Sweet 16, which even that, we were surprised to see Dickinson make it through. So now that they're still going and they are on the other side of the Elite Eight and semifinal, it's even more impressive. But what I think is really important there and still continues to reign true is a lot of the aspects that we talk about with his team, what happened at the midseason mark, and all of the different aspects that had kind of led to that Red Devil turnaround. So if you are interested in that, we would really appreciate you backtracking and headed to go check out a little bit of that detail.
Yep.
And now we get to the head coach of the Tufts lacrosse program, Coach Casey D'Onofrio.
By the head coach of Tufts lacrosse, Coach Casey D'Onofrio. Coach, I know it is a crazy, crazy week. How you holding up?
Doing great, man. You know, great problems to have. You know, just having so many people want to talk to you and figure out what's going to go on this weekend. So we're really grateful for that situation. But yeah, you know, just a little sleep deprivation. You know, I know you got little kids. This is kind of like a return to old for me, back when they were really little. But no, man, it's just, you know, you wake up every morning, you're just excited. Really excited to get back to work and, you know, just play a team we've never played before, you know, is a tall task, but it's also an exciting one. So we're looking forward to it.
And you mentioned a team that you've never played before, and they are on, you know, quite the tear right now and seem to have a little bit of a special mojo. And so hoping you can kind of talk a little bit about what you see, you know, on tape recently and what, you know, Dickinson is kind of bringing to the table now here at this phase of the season that, you know, maybe was different from early in the season.
Yeah, for sure. They, you know, when we played at the Mustang Classic earlier in the year, they were the game before us when they were playing RIT and we were playing Hamilton. So so we had a chance to watch the first half of their RIT game. And to say they're a different team now would be an incredible understatement. They are just so good. You know, they defensively, they get out and attack you. You know, they're incredibly tough. You know, and then on the offensive end, they're really disciplined. They do a great job getting into their sets and getting the looks that they want to get to. And they are just playing with such a swagger and a confidence right now. You know, we really do have our work cut out for us this weekend and this week for prep. So, you know, hats off to Coach Webster for, you know, getting his guys rolling. And, you know, we've got to play a great game of lacrosse on Sunday to have a chance to win this thing.
And let's quickly shift gears and talk jumbos for a second. Obviously, playing in a game at this type of magnitude, at this stage, and in this type of atmosphere is going to potentially lend itself to some new eyes, some fans that haven't seen Tufts play before. So from your perspective, like, what are some of the things that you would expect them to see, and what are some of the things that, you know, you would hope they kind of leave thinking about your program?
It's a great question. You know, I think one, we're really excited to play in New England. Such an incredible privilege and such a great opportunity for us. You know, I hope that people come away from it feeling like they saw a really fun brand of lacrosse, that they saw a really motivated and hardworking team. And, you know, I think for us, you know, we're really trying to, you know, just grow the game and have little kids see it and, you know, feel like, hey, like lacrosse is really fun. I'd much rather play that than baseball, you know, and, you know, with our guys running and celebrating and, you know, hopefully scoring a lot of goals. We hope that we can inspire some young guys and girls that, you know, haven't seen a lot of lacrosse to be like, man, that looks like a lot of fun. I want to try that. So, you know, hopefully we can get up and down. Hopefully we can push the pace. Hopefully we can generate a lot of shots and some turnovers. And, you know, just try and play our brand of up-tempo lacrosse.
And you mentioned that tempo, and it lends itself to, you know, lots of turnovers, or creating turnovers, excuse me. It lends itself to high shot numbers, lends itself typically to high goal totals, all of that types of stuff. But furthermore, like within that, like what do you kind of teach your guys to be able to go through those phases of the game and be, you know, still controlled, where you're finding that fine line of, you know, control and comfort from chaos, which I feel like a lot of teams, when they try to play that type of pace, end up on the wrong side of that balance?
No, it's a great question. I think it's really just process driven. We do everything we can in practice to simulate the speed, the tempo, and the looks that we're going to give and we're going to get. And one of the things that we do is we don't do a lot of yelling at practice. You know, practice is basically 80% of it is one big heat check. You know, let's figure out what works. Let's figure out how fast we can play. Let's make mistakes of commission where we're going 100 miles an hour and at 100% when we make the mistake, and we'll get it on film and we'll look at it and we'll see if it works. And if it does, great. We'll double down on that. And if it doesn't, we'll try and, you know, manipulate it and make some changes in a way that we think, you know, could be a little bit better the next time that we do it. And so, you know, if you come to a Tufts practice, you're going to see, you know, I think pretty much what you see on game day, where is a ton of excitement, super high tempo. You know, we probably play a little bit faster in practice than we do in games, just because it is us versus us and not, you know, versus a team that's trying to slow us down. And, you know, our guys are just lax rats. You know, they love watching the film. They love analyzing it. And so, you know, the fact that we film everything that we do and they can go back and look at it and ask questions, and we can, as a staff, you know, put together clips that they can look at, you know, really helps us play at that speed and that tempo. And really the only time that I'll get you know, super upset with guys in games is if they're doing things that they didn't do in practice or if they're, you know, not going at 100%. If, you know, anything besides that is usually pretty good to go.
And to piggyback off of part of that answer there, you mentioned how some of the teams and are a big piece of their, you know, piece of the puzzle, what they're going to try and prioritize is just slowing the pace. And so from what you guys have seen so far this season, like what are some of the strategies and tactics that fans can be looking for that maybe Dickinson is going to try and use or try and utilize or try and deploy to try and slow that pace down a little bit?
I think the most important thing for us in terms of determining the pace of the game is, well, one, it's ground balls, but also kind of 1A, 1B would be face-offs, ground balls. If we can do a great job there, you know, earning some extra possessions, that will be really helpful for us. But, you know, again, if you play a high-tempo defense and you put the ball on the ground, you need to pick it up so they can go get extra possessions that way as well. You know, we're also seeing that Dickinson does a great job on shot backups. So we're really hammering that with our offensive guys this week to not get beat on shot backups. So just I think between the ground balls and, you know, and again, just making sure that they don't steal any possessions, that's a way that we can, you know, get 7, 8, 9 extra possessions during the game. And, you know, if we can capitalize on half of those, we feel like that'll be, you know, a good way for us to help get to the place that we want to get to.
And then I'd love to try and continue to piggyback off of that defensive concept. And I feel like so often when people think about Tufts or think about any team that likes to play this pace or this style of play, it's so much about like, what do they do with the balls in their stick? But I think a lot of it is, you know, the backbone of the defensive side to put the ball on the ground or to give you the faith that if you do go and you turn it over a few times more, that you know that your defense is going to hold up on the back end anyways. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, your defensive personnel and, you know, just what those guys are able to bring to the table in terms of serving that structure?
It's a great question. I think a lot of times teams will, you know, kind of pack it in defensively and, you know, kind of allow the offense to dictate the way that they want to play. And I think we are the opposite of that. We really want to try and dictate the speed of the offense. We want to try and speed them up as best we can. And then just really focusing on both like our slide tempo and our breakout tempo. And if we can create, you know, balls on the ground, if we can get guys nervous when they catch the ball, if we can get them making decisions in shorter amount of time so that they're, you know, they don't have all of the information and then maybe they throw a bad pass or they throw it away or they throw it to a covered guy. You know, that's what we're trying to do with our tempo on defense. And then, you know, on shots, we want to make sure that we're breaking out and we're just putting pressure on the other team that way so that they know, oh, shoot, if my shot gets saved, not only am I turning the ball over, but I'm potentially giving up transition the other way. So, just trying to focus in those two areas. Both of those have to do with tempo and both of those have to do with, you know, creating ways to add additional possessions and additional, you know, odd man rushes, if you will. So, you know, that's a lot of what we, you know, a lot of what we try and do in our 6-on-6 stuff, but also in any of that small sided stuff that we do out of practice as well.
And of course, everything that happens once that first whistle blows is, you know, you hope you to be able to control a little bit and you hope you have some prediction of the outcome and some sort of semblance of what's going to happen. But in this night on this stage, there's probably more variables than any. And so that's a really good kind of point to kind of segue into talking about the moment, right? An undefeated team. There's only so many teams that have been able to do it and climb the mountain with that status. You reached that similar status, got to this point in 23. Obviously, we're able to rinse the taste out and, you know, truly climb the mountain in 2024. So curious how here in 2025, you are able to kind of take your experiences as a staff or as a locker room from the previous 2 years and make sure that this Sunday ends up with another one of those victories.
It's a really good question. It's obviously something that we've thought a lot about. You know, I think that we, this week especially, we've talked about 23 a lot and just being like, hey, everything you've done up to this point doesn't really matter. It's all about how hard you're going to work this week. And I think just hearkening back to last year when I think from the moment we lost in the conference quarterfinals until the national championship, you know, we put in the work, we did the extras, we had the aggression and the anger that we needed to play with. And so really being able to compare those two things has been valuable for us. And then, you know, having Mike Morgan on staff who went back to back at Merrimack, being able to talk to our guys and talk about the journey and the pitfalls and the things that they really fell back on. You know, our guys have been eating that up this week as well. So, you know, to your point, it's really just, you know, being able to have those experiences in the bank, and being able to withdraw those experiences or parts of those experiences on a regular basis. You know, but one of the things that we've talked about the most is really, hey, like on your goal sheet, how many of you had go undefeated and nobody raises their hand? And how many of you had win the national championship and everybody raises their hand? And, you know, so I think their focus is not so much on going undefeated as it is, you know, taking care of business on Sunday. So we're not really feeling any pressure in terms of finishing with an undefeated record. I think where we put pressure on ourselves is to, you know, just get the job done.
Perfect. All right, Coach, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And before I let you go, is there anything else that you'd like to add, or, you know, anything else that you expect fans can expect here on Sunday night?
Yeah, I just think the whole weekend's an awesome weekend for lacrosse. And even if you're, you know, again, we have the D1 women's game is at noon and D2 men's game is at 4. So, you know, it's just such a cool experience. I remember going as a fan, going as a high school kid, and then going obviously to Tufts games before I was coaching there. So it's just such a cool experience. Even if you're not a fan of lacrosse or a fan of any of the teams, just go check it out. I mean, it is so cool. The atmosphere is intoxicating, and I would just, anybody who's on the fence, jump over the fence, go do it. Yeah, it's so cool. And give it a try. And I can promise you, you will not be disappointed by it.
All right, Coach. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time, and best of luck this weekend.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Appreciate it, man.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.